Joining us to talk about what the rhetoric means and what the actual developments mean is Khan Hallinan. He's a columnist with Foreign Policy in Focus, someone who understands military hardware better than just about anyone else on the left. Thank you for coming in, sir.
Thanks for having me here.
What's Donald Trump doing differently?
Nothing really. I mean, this is part of his sound and fury style of politics. It's sort of international politics as a variety of the bachelorette of reality TV. He comes in, he says, he's talking to his base, he says, you guys aren't paying the bills, you have to pay more of the bills, and that plays well among his base. You know, these foreigners are taking advantage of us and that kind of thing. But, you know, in the end, they signs the agreement that everybody else signed on to. Certainly, the United States is not going to withdraw from NATO. NATO is incredibly important for the United States. People forget that the war in Afghanistan is not a U.S. war, that it's a NATO war. And NATO gives enormous amount of cover to what is now going on 18 years of war, and a war which, by the way, is also pretty clear violation of international law. So NATO is an enormous asset to the United States, and that, you know, he's not going to withdraw from it, but he's going to make as much political hay out of it as he can.
The other political signaling he seemed to be doing was about the U.S. as arms dealer. He talked to the press corps about how great our hardware is and how he's looking forward to selling more of it to the Europeans.
Yeah, really. He was like a used car salesman. He really was. He wants them to up it to 4%, which, as you pointed out, Brian, is larger than we spend. I think we spend between 3.8 and 3.9% of our gross domestic product on weapons. Although that's a bit of a misnomer, because a lot of what we spend on military things gets hidden. For instance, that doesn't include nuclear weapons, because nuclear weapons are under the Energy Department. So there are all sorts of little ways that that we do things like that. And given that the focus is on Russia, that's what the statement was really aimed at, then this is sort of big nation competition, which is what the Trump administration came in saying, that they were switching from the war against terrorism to the war to great nation competition, particularly China and Russia. Well, those are big ticket weapons. Those are fancy airplanes. They're big ships. They're fancy tanks. They're expensive. And gee, the Americans makes them. So even though we don't do what we do just because of the arms company, you know, Boeing and General Atomics and Lockheed Martin all have a seat at the table. And that was very much, and you can see them waving their hands in the back saying, yeah, we got all those things, we can provide them.
Well, you've talked about signaling towards the American electorate and towards American arms manufacturers. Do you see any signaling towards Vladimir Putin and Russia going into their summit with Donald Trump next week?
I don't think so. I think the Russians probably look at this and are probably as cynical as I am about it. You know, I think the problem with what we're seeing here is that the American media is not really doing the story, which is to really examine what is NATO. And should NATO really exist? Now, the idea was, when NATO was originally set up, there was an old slogan. NATO was formed to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. That was the sort of slogan of NATO. It was formed in 1949. The Warsaw Pact was not formed until 1955.
Warsaw Pact was the military alliance
of communist
powers. Was the military alliance
of the Soviet Union. And after the Soviet Union fell, when people got a chance to go into the archives of the Russian military, they found that the Russians never had a plan to invade Western Europe. The Russians were not stupid. I mean, they knew that any invasion of Western Europe would be a nuclear war, and that would immediately get out of hand. So this whole idea of the aggressive Russians, the revanchist Russians. Obama said that the Russia was attempting to recover lost glory through force, kind of stuff. The Russian bugaboo. That has been the kind of impetus to spreading, to increasing military spending. But if you look at the record, what you find is that you take a look at a record map of Europe in 1988 and you look at it today, it's quite obvious who's going in what direction. In 1990, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl and Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev sat down. They came to an agreement that the Soviets would withdraw all military forces from Eastern Europe on the condition that NATO not move east of Germany. That was the agreement. Well, today, virtually all members of the Warsaw Pact are members of NATO. NATO is carrying out military maneuvers on the Russian border. The Obama administration put anti-ballistic missile bases in Eastern Europe, supposedly aimed at Iran. Iran doesn't even have any rockets, let alone nuclear weapons, to reach Western Europe. So from the point of view of the Russians, they see NATO moving eastward. And I think the key moment in that was the Serbian War in 1999. And after that, the Russians decided that NATO was coming for them. And they started, pulling the wagons in a circle. And it's been that way ever since.
Speaking of Con Hallinan, he's a military analyst and a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. What do you make of the specific jab at Germany in which Donald Trump called Germany a quote-unquote captive of Russia?
Because Donald Trump wants the Germans to use American oil and American gas and that comes from fracking. That's what this is all about. The Nord 2 line, which is a new, I think it's $12 billion pipeline that runs from Russia to Germany. It's very important for German industry. It's low-cost gas. It's also environmentally sound. And the Germans, have made a commitment to end all nuclear power plants and to reduce greenhouse gases. So natural gas coming in on the Nord 2 is not only good for German industry, but it also fits into the Germans' approach to what they should be doing environmentally around the Paris Climate Accords. So, of course, he's going to pound on this. It's interesting how he creates these adversaries. First he created North Korea that was Rocket Man, so he goes after the North Koreans. Then he actually went after the South Koreans. Then he goes after he's been going after the Germans for some time. The Germans are doing this. He goes after the Canadians. The Canadians are a national security threat. That's his way of doing it. It makes it very simple for his own base. You create these kind of bugaboos and you put them up there and you attack them. And, I think the attack on Germany, from his point of view, it had more to do with the fact of trying to disarm Germany as a critic of American foreign policy. And I think that's the main thing. But there is another element, too. Anywhere that Trump goes, he is surrounded by corporations. And those corporations are constantly whispering into his ear, mother's milk is a bad idea. Take formula, make them buy big ticket military items. there's just whispering. It's right in his ear all the time.
It also comes at a time when the government of German Chancellor Angela Merkel is in the weakest position it's been in during her tenure, being destabilized from surprisingly strong challenges from the xenophobic right within Germany. Do you think there's more than just signaling, that there's some power politics there?
Well, I think that one of the things that, if you recall, the American ambassador to Germany very, very explicitly said that he was encouraging parties like Alternative for Germany. And keep in mind, when we're talking about the European right, Some of this ride is extremely dangerous.
And alternative for Germany is the next best thing to modern-day Nazis.
Yeah.
Modern-day Nazis would be illegal in Germany.
Sure. The one of the leaders of the alternative for Germany said that a Holocaust memorial in Berlin was a slap in the face to all Germans. I mean, except the ones they put in ovens, of course. And who has called for, and this is his word, celebrating the exploits of the Wehrmacht, mm-hmm. which was the Nazi army. The People's Party in Austria was formed in the early 1950s, not just by Nazis, by former members of the SS. So these are dangerous people. But I think the problem here is that you do have a crisis in Europe. But in terms of explaining why the right is doing well, I think that what you have to do is to look at the failure of the center and the center left. That for decades, really ever since Maggie Thatcher came into power in 1979 in Britain, the center left has gone along with many of the politics of neoliberalism. Tony Blair is a perfect example. But essentially, center-left parties in Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, France, put in policies that have created enormous economic inequality in Europe. And if you want to understand what the base of the right is in Europe today, it is this growing crisis of economic inequality. And it's not just limited to Europe. Obviously, it exists in the United States. In fact, it's a crisis of global capitalism itself. And, you know, my concern is that to respond to something like the Alternative for Germany or the Front in France or the League in Italy, etc., with, you know, look, we need to have liberal democracy, instead of you have this crisis where young people can't get jobs. When they do get jobs, they're gig jobs. From 2013 to 2016, of the 5.2 million jobs that were created in the European Union, 2.3 million of them were temp jobs that either had no benefits or very low benefits and absolutely no job security whatsoever. So this is where the crisis lies. And the center left and the center and the left has not been addressing it. And only two places where they have done that, in Portugal and in England, they've actually done quite well. They've really made some progress. So I think what you're seeing here is that you really do have a crisis in Europe. You have a crisis in capitalism. And nobody's reporting on that. I mean, the press is so enamored of this bachelorette approach to foreign policy, and then they're sucked in by it, and they can't help themselves. You know, they sort of latch onto it. In the meantime, the real issues and the real problems, which are behind this growth of the right and the crisis in the European Union, those are not being addressed, and they're not being reported upon. And that is, I consider, a scary thing.
So one of the key ways that this crisis is taking shape in Europe is a extreme conflict over the flow of refugees, and this is one of the ways in which Merkel has been weakened in recent weeks. So we're now, so far we've been discussing the NATO summit through the lens of mm-hmm. Donald Trump. So let's turn it around. What was the NATO summit intended to achieve for the Europeans involved, and did it achieve any of those goals?
I don't think it did particularly, and I quite agree with you that the question of the immigration is such a central point now. Sort of ironic, because actually the immigration is greatly down
in the United States.
No, in Europe.
There's the lowest
number of refugees since 2012 in Europe. The other thing that's interesting about it, and again, it's this thing of, you know, sort of, you know, not talking about the elephant in the living room. Europe has a crisis, and the crisis is that the birth rates have fallen all over Europe. They average in the EU about 1.58. In order to have a standard replication rate, you have to have 2.1. That's the That's a standard formula for that. The irony is that immigration played the central role in the Italian elections. Italy has the second lowest birth rate in the world. Mm-hmm. Only Japan is lower. It has a 1.39% replacement rate. They lose the equivalent of the population of Bologna every 3 years, about 75,000 people. In 30 years, their pension system will collapse. Their infrastructures will collapse. They will literally, as a social system, they will collapse. Germany needs 500,000 immigrants every single year for the next 30 years. Otherwise, their pension and healthcare system will collapse as well. So what you see, and then this, we see this in the United States, we also are below 2.1, but we have had a fairly robust, you know, flow of immigrants in. What's interesting here is that this is a really serious problem, and it's going to cause it's going to exacerbate the crisis that already exists about economic inequality, because the solution to it is to cut pensions, to cut subsidies, to cut education, to cut public transport.
And you're saying that's the solution that voters in European powers are hearing from their center-left parties?
Yes.
And then the right saying the solution is to keep the immigrants out.
That's right.
And nobody's saying, at least nobody with a big toehold in politics, actually, we need the immigrants. We need them working. We need their contributions to our safety net.
Yeah.
If we want to have the programs that you all care about.
Yeah, and they're afraid to do that. I mean, they know that. I mean, they actually know that. The woman in Italy, the woman who was the interior minister and who was a member of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party was a split from the old Italian Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and she kind of had a little separate party of her own. She's a left person. She was the only person who was out there saying, you're going to kill us all. If we don't bring these immigrants in, you're literally going to kill Italian society. But nobody listened to her, and the left was too afraid to take on that issue. They saw that as a third rail. The result is that we're going to have an absolutely massive crisis in Europe. Not caused by immigrants coming in, you know, with different cultures and languages and religions, but by a lack of those. The response of the Democratic Party's labor minister before the election, remember, this is a socialist party, asked what he was going to do about youth unemployment, which is just a crisis in Italy. He said that young people should emigrate and, quote, not get under our feet, unquote. Now, would you vote for that guy? Mm. Instead, they voted for Pepo Grillo and the Five Star Party, which is a very creepy outfit.
Yeah, well, it's like a reality TV mashup of positions.
It is.
Including some pretty
And by the way, have gone right along with the Northern League's anti-immigrant stuff.
Wow, Con Hallinan. Good morning to you, too.
They either put people to sleep or really woke them up. Thank you for having me.
What are you going to be watching for with next week's Russia Summit?
You know, I think the thing that has to happen, the situation right now between the United States and Russia and the Western allies, regardless of what you think of Putin, and I ain't no fan. I don't like the oligarchy. I don't like what I see in Russia. They are not a threat. The Russians are not going to come and get us. But they do have the potential to destroy life, or at least civilization, on the Earth. So what I'd like to see to come out of it is a gradual rollback now of these sanctions, and a normal, logical relationship with the rest of the West. I mean, British chief of staff, military chief of staff, made a comment recently that said that the relationships with Russia, it feels like the eve of 1914, World War I. This is nuts, and also really dangerous. There are a lot of places that the United States is going to disagree with the Russians, but there are a lot of places they can work together. Syria being the most obvious, Iran being a very obvious area, let alone things like climate accord, etc. But the main thing is reduce the tension in Europe. Stop maneuvering troops on each other's borders. Stop pouring American troops into the Baltic countries, into Poland, etc. Take those ABM launchers out of them, out of Europe. That's what I'd like to see come out of it. Do I expect that to come out of it? I live in a dream world sometimes.
Con Hallinan, thank you so much for coming
thank
in.
You My so pleasure. Much for being with us.
Con Hallinan is a columnist with Foreign Policy in Focus.